A high school valedictorian stands before his graduating class and does something unthinkable. He questions whether he deserves to be there at all. Justin Hudson's 2010 speech at Hunter College High School wasn't false modesty. It was a public reckoning with a system that claims to reward merit but increasingly rewards privilege. We are being taught that those who possess academic and intellectual skills deserve more than others, he told his stunned audience. His words captured something millions of Americans were beginning to feel. The game is rigged, and those running it are either blind to the rigging or complicit in it. This is the landscape we now inhabit, a nation where trust in institutions has collapsed to levels worse than during the American Revolution. Congress pulls lower than communism. Banks are trusted by barely 1 in 5 Americans. The Catholic Church, Wall Street, the media, even democracy itself, all hemorrhaging credibility. We've witnessed the Iraq War's false pretenses, Hurricane Katrina's abandonment, the 2008 financial crisis's betrayal, and countless corporate scandals. What connects these failures isn't just incompetence, but a deeper crisis. Those in power no longer experience the consequences of their decisions. We worship meritocracy with religious fervor. Goldman Sachs opens its recruiting pitch declaring itself a meritocracy. After the 2009 financial crisis, 72% of Americans still believed you could start out poor, work hard, and become rich. The uncomfortable truth? America is now less socially mobile than nearly every other industrialized democracy. Canada is 2.5 times more mobile, Denmark 3 times more. Born into the bottom fifth, you have a 42% chance of staying there and only 6% of reaching the top. The term meritocracy was coined as a warning. British politician Michael Young created it in his 1958 dystopian novel about a future where intelligence testing created a rigid new aristocracy. He intended satire, we embraced it as gospel. Hunter College High School exemplifies this paradox. Admission rests solely on 1 3-hour test. No legacy preferences, no connections. Yet, as inequality intensified, the entering class went from 12% Black and 6% Hispanic in 1995 to just 3% and 1% by 2009. Manhattan parents paying $90 per hour for test prep had pulled the ladder up behind them. This reveals the iron law of meritocracy. Eventually, the inequality produced by a meritocratic system grows large enough to subvert the mobility mechanisms themselves. Whoever says meritocracy says oligarchy. Before Wall Street's 2008 collapse, Enron epitomized corporate scandal. $60 billion in stock value destroyed, 5,600 jobs eliminated, $2.1 billion in pension funds vaporized. CEO Jeff Skilling built what he called a perfect meritocracy that explicitly rewarded rule-breaking if it produced profits. When one executive directly defied his orders but created a profitable venture, she faced no consequences. The message was clear: rules are for losers. Baseball's steroid era reveals the same pattern. When Jose Canseco transformed from skinny minor leaguer into what teammates called a freaking Macy's balloon, his salary jumped from $75,000 to $1.6 million in 3 years. He became a chemical evangelist, teaching players what to inject. By 2002, Ken Caminiti estimated half the league was using. Even Barry Bonds started in 1999, after watching Maguire and Sosa receive adulation he felt he deserved. Why didn't anyone stop it? Steroids were profitable. In 2007, as the scandal surfaced, MLB broke its attendance record for the fourth straight season, with revenue hitting $5.5 billion. Both management and unions stayed silent. They were making too much money. Two factors prevent cheating: ethical norms and fear of punishment. Baseball had neither. No testing existed before 2003, and as more players used drugs, moral condemnation evaporated. When cheating becomes institutional norm, those at the top develop cultures of open secrets, inside jokes signaling moral corruption. At Countrywide Financial, when an employee asked what to do if a borrower mentioned being unemployed, his supervisor replied, I wouldn't deny it because I didn't hear anything. I would definitely tell the sales counselor to shut up or shoot him.
Intelligence has become our supreme value, spawning a destructive cult of smartness where brilliance is treated as a clear, rankable hierarchy. Legal elites dismiss Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor as not that smart, despite her Princeton summa cum laude and Yale law credentials. Wall Street analysts look down on investment bankers as second-class intellects, while those same bankers believe they work with the brightest people in the world. This obsession creates dangerous authority. America follows Wall Street because they've supposedly got the smartest minds on the planet. Yet smartness without wisdom or ethics becomes destructive. The Bush administration's most disastrous decisions came from figures like David Addington, whose dazzling legal knowledge enabled him to steamroll opposition and push extreme policies. This reveals the cult of smartness's dark core, not genuine appreciation for intelligence, but the desire to differentiate and dominate. Meanwhile, those at the top have grown isolated from society. Nearly every Obama administration figure was worth millions. Larry Summers, $17 to $39 million. Gene Sperling, $2.2 million in consulting fees. This creates fractal inequality, vast gaps at every level. At Davos, even billionaires feel wildly insecure about their hotel rooms or dinner invitations, forever chasing entrance to the next exclusive circle.
America's founding grievances centered on distance. King George III ruled from an ocean away, making responsive governance impossible. No taxation without representation captured this crisis. When rulers don't experience their decisions' effects, the feedback loop breaks. Thomas Paine stressed that elected officials must keep mixing with voters to prevent forming separate interests. Power corrupts by narrowing vision. Even briefly induced feelings of power profoundly affect behavior. The powerful think more abstractly, stereotype more readily, take greater risks, and show less empathy. Lower-class individuals consistently score higher on empathic accuracy because their survival depends on understanding those with power over them. This social distance explains institutional failures across sectors. In the Catholic Church abuse scandal, bishops extended compassion toward fellow clergymen while treating victims with cold officiousness. Hurricane Katrina's evacuation plan failed because officials didn't know 47% of New Orleans' poor lacked cars. America has been at war continuously since 9/11, yet these wars are literally costless for most citizens, financed through debt while taxes declined. Only 2% of fighting-age adults serve in the military, creating a dangerous disconnect between decision-makers and those bearing war's burdens. America experienced two remarkable equality eras. Post-World War II to the early 1970s brought unprecedented economic growth with declining inequality. Union membership peaked at 34%, CEO pay stayed around 25-to-1 worker compensation, and the poorest 20% saw the largest income gains. The second era, mid-1970s to today, delivered dramatic improvements in racial, gender, and sexual orientation equality, with more diverse leadership and historic civil rights advances. But during that second era, economic inequality soared. The top 10% captured all income gains, while the bottom 90% saw declines. CEO pay skyrocketed to 185 times worker compensation. We must combine the best of both eras, recognizing that true meritocracy flourishes only with relatively equal outcomes. Reducing inequality is achievable. Higher taxation correlates with less inequality across developed nations, and Americans broadly support taxing the wealthy. The obstacle isn't public opposition, it's that those benefiting from extreme inequality wield outsized power to protect their interests. The newly radicalized upper middle class, frustrated professionals who feel dispossessed despite their education, forms a potential source of transformation. This demographic powers both progressive and conservative movements, united by rage at discovering the game is rigged.
The twilight of the elites isn't the end of leadership. It's the beginning of rebuilding institutions worthy of trust, where those who govern remain connected to those they serve, where success reflects genuine merit rather than inherited advantage, and where the distance between powerful and powerless shrinks enough that we can see each other clearly again.